Hello and welcome to the Keeper Cup podcast. Chad Young and Pete Ball here. And it's been a while, Pete. We haven't talked to the people in a long time. There was, I had the flu. There was some travel. There were all sorts of things that crept up. And all of a sudden we, you know, you're going every other week. You miss an episode. Boom, it's been a month. And we went from, you know, keeper deadline fast approaching to like, I don't know about you, but I am in the middle of draft season.
Yeah, it hasn't picked up entirely for me. And like, you know, as we were talking about before the show started, I have this week off from school. So like, I'm trying to like figure out what to do and putting off doing like housework and stuff. So I joined another NFBC 50s, got the first pick, got my first share, Bobby Witt Jr. But that's my only draft right now. Most of mine are like mid-March, closer to the start of the season.
You took Witt over Otani?
Oh, so it was... I'm not even like considering Otani because it's weekly lineups. So like the fact that he's hitter and pitcher really doesn't mean anything.
Doesn't help.
And I'm worried he's not going to run as much this year. I would normally take Aaron Judge, but I already have like quite a few Aaron Judge shares. So I just wanted to get some Bobby Witt.
That makes sense. That's a totally reasonable thing to want. I'm sort of fascinated, and maybe we can talk about this with Otani a little later, but I'm fascinated to know like what his pitching looks like this year, because he's not going to go on a rehab assignment when he's ready, which means he's going to like throw some bullpens and then just face major league hitters. So that seems a little concerning to me, but we'll get to that in a bit. But first, it is episode 159 of the Keeper Cup podcast, and jersey number 59. it's not a great jersey number. I've got a guy who's a fit for me for this episode, because Carlos Carrasco wore 59 for most of his career, including all of his years with the Guardians. And so I'm happy to give this to him. And I don't really see a ton of other obvious candidates, Pete. I don't know.
Carrasco, correct me if I'm wrong, Carrasco's a cancer survivor, right?
He is, yes.
Oh, then heck yeah, we're going with Carlos Carrasco.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, a legitimately great pitcher in his prime.
Yeah, he was a consistent top 20 guy for quite a bit.
Yeah, so did he sign with the Yankees, the Mets? He signed with someone.
Definitely not.
Yeah, the Yankees.
What? Really? Was it a minor league deal?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, he was...
I was just looking at their rotation because of Stroman's comments, and I did not see Carrasco, but it must have been because he's on the AAA.
No, yeah. And he was, I mean, like, Carrasco last year had a 5.64 ERA, and, you know, the FIP... A little better. XFIP was 4.18, Sierra 4.28. Like, there's some underlying stuff that isn't awful, but he's been pretty bad the last couple years. Yeah. And really, three of the last 4 years, like, he had a little bit of a bounce back in 2022, but it's been pretty ugly other than that. He's 38 years old, or he will be 38 by opening day, at least by the Yankees opening day. He'll turn 38 in between the Japan opening day and the stateside opening day. But I don't know. You know, it's this moment for me with like a guy like Carrasco who I personally have enjoyed so much as a pitcher, and his personal story, as you mentioned, cancer survivor. And by all reports, he's just a great dude. You want to like, hey, you want to keep trying, you want to keep going out there, you should,
yeah, whatever.
More power to you. But I also feel like maybe it's time. Like,
enjoy your millions.
Maybe it's time. But hey, we'll see. You know, the Yankees, they could use some pitching depth, so maybe he'll add some value there. We'll see how that minor league portion goes for him, and I don't know. But yeah, Carlos Carrasco, this is your episode. You've earned it. So today, Pete and I are going to talk about how I can't stop coughing is what we're going to talk about. I'm going to be doing that all episode. I apologize. I'll do my best to clean that up in production. But we're going to talk about draft results. As I said, we're into draft season. We've had some drafts that have already happened. And Pete, in the last 10 days ish. You and I have been through two auto new auctions. Yeah. That
I kind of went through two. I went through like one and a half, but yeah.
Yeah, you lost power during one of them or something, right?
I lost internet, and my wife had my phone because she was out, and so and her phone was broken. So I was just kind of up a creek without a paddle. But I was really happy, not that this is what it's about, with the all the $1 guys that I got to round out my team. I thought I really lucked out. So championship hopes are still alive.
Well, it's actually, I think it's actually not a bad place to start, because I think one of the things people sometimes get caught up in is, you know, the draft being this like everything happens in the draft, you have to be there, you got to be there for the dollar days at the end, grab those $1 guys. And I was just looking at the end of that auction, and I was involved in that auction right up until the end. I got a $1 Ryan Nelson is like the 10th last pick or something like that.
Nice.
After him, $1 Tobias Myers, $1 Edouard Julien, Dalton Varsho, Max Meyer, Josue DePaula, Brian Hayes, Blake Treinen, Kiebert Ruiz. Those were the last sort of 10-ish $1 guys. There's a few other names, you know, Dustin May, Cedric Mullins, Yoan Moncada, Tyler Molly. The last guy to go for more than a buck was a $2 TJ Friedel. Like, that was sort of the end game that everybody was dealing with. And like you said, you missed the end of the auction and you started, I don't know, like 12 auctions right away. And your $1 guys, you got through those, you know, 48 hour auctions immediately after the full auction, were Bryce Terang, Joey Bart, Davis Schneider, Luis Severino, Jose Barrios, Hunter Gaddis, Eric Fetty, Luke Weaver, Michael Busch. Oh, you actually paid $2 for Weaver. Michael Busch, Drew Gilbert, Chase Meidroth, Franklin Arias, Ricky Tiedemann, Brady House, Ryan Weathers, Kevin Alcantara. You already cut Meidroth. But this is a 4x4 league, by the way, the Keeper Cut Listener League. So you built most of a bullpen. You got yourself a guy in Busch who I think is at least a useful or interesting 1B option. He's not my favorite. I'm not a huge Michael Busch fan, but for a buck, sure. You got yourself some interesting prospects. And you did that all after, and a couple of arms, like Severino is an interesting arm at least. Barrios should eat you some innings, if nothing else. Fetty could be interesting. Like, you got that all despite missing the last hour-ish of the auction.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So I think it's worth noting that a couple of things here. One, you don't necessarily have to be there for every second of the auction. It is okay to just be like, you know what? I'm done. Either because your internet's out or because you just, you know, want to go spend time with your kids or watch a TV show or anything else. The other thing is, even if you are there till the end, like, pay attention to what's still out there. A lot of guys get missed at the auction. People aren't, you know, people are scrambling, looking at their sheets, trying to make their picks, and they aren't necessarily going to take the best players, or at least the guys that you think are the best players. And so there's often names that are still out there after the auction's over that are worth picking up.
Yeah, I was pretty pleased with a lot of the names I saw. Clearly, some of those names, it was just, I'm trying to basically fill up my roster and, you know, who are some guys who could like jump into the top 10 prospect rankings and end up being a piece that I could move or something like that. That's where, like, you know, the Franklin Arias comes from and stuff like that. I did make one critical error in this auction, where, like, something you need to pay attention to in fantasy keeper leagues and dynasty leagues where, like, you have players carrying over from last year, is that their positions will change. And it looks like, for sure, at this point, I'd say, unless they, well, actually, no, I don't know if there's any move out there that this team would make that would change this. The Jazz Chisholm is going to gain second base eligibility very, very quickly into the season. And I kind of backed myself into a corner where I ended up spending $37 on Marcus Semien. Now, I think I cut him at 42. So I could walk away from this looking like, oh, I totally did that on purpose, knowing I would save $5. But I really didn't want to have to spend so much money on Marcus Semien. I just knew that second base, you know, was going to be thin, and you know, somebody just kept bidding me up, and I didn't want to lose out on the player. I think he does play up in this format. I think last year was just a down year. I think he's going to be an asset, so it's really not the end of the world. But I just wonder how I would have played that out if I remembered and took the 5 seconds it would have taken to look at my roster and see who's going to gain position eligibility that Jazz Chisholm could take over second base for me. But otherwise, to bring it back to what you're talking about, all those $1 moves, yeah, I'm pretty happy with them. If you're surprised that Bryce Terang was available because his ADP is like in the top 100 right now, he sucks in this format. It was just more like, again, filling out my roster. He'll probably get cut. It was Tiedemann, honestly, and believe it or not, because you know me, I'm not a reliever guy. In the two relievers that I got that I think I was most happy about, that I think could have the most impact for my roster this year, Tiedemann probably via trade if he gets a lot of his prospect shine back. And those two relievers, Weaver and Gattis, I mean, those are studs. I can't believe those guys made it with, you know, 12 teams. Everybody's got five relievers. I'm just kind of surprised those guys made it to the end. But wasn't ideal, but I still feel like I'm in contention.
Yeah, Gattis and Weaver are an interesting combination, too, because Gattis doesn't quite pile up the strikeouts like a lot of other top relievers. And Weaver, partially just because Yankee Stadium is Yankee Stadium, isn't quite as a quite as great a home run play in a league that has a home run per nine category, but they complement each other really, really well in that regard. Like, you know, you could easily look at Gattis's line and be like, oh, it's not enough strikeouts, but the home run per nine is great. You can easily look at Weaver's line and be like, man, that's a lot of strikeouts, but he's given up more home runs than I really want my relievers to give up. But if you combine their numbers from last year, you've got 158 and two-thirds innings, 169 strikeouts, and a home run per nine around 0.7, I think. And that's pretty great. Like, that, that's a good combination of guys. Now, you need a full bullpen, and, you know, we'll see, like, what does Porter Hodge do? What does Robert Suarez do? But you've got the right pieces in place. Romano, I think, is going to be a nice pickup for you. You've got the nice pieces in place. Like you said, two of those guys you were able to pick up for a dollar after the auction was over. So there's opportunities to do stuff like that late on, for sure. Let's talk a little bit about Semien, because like you said, I was surprised he went for as much as he did. Yes, he was cut at 42, but looking across my leagues right now, I've had three auctions so far. He's gone for 37 in this one, 31 in the Fangraphs staff league that you and I will talk about in a little bit, and for 23 in a Sabre points league. So those other two are points leagues. His average salary is around $25. His last 10 auctions, last 10 prices are even lower than that. I understand what you were saying about, like, oh, I wish I'd realized Jazz could have just stepped in. You know, you could have gone with Horner and Terang short term and fine. But is Semien, I mean, this feels like it's almost twice what he should cost.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, and that's the thing with auctions, especially a few years into leagues, right? Where like some guys are just naturally going to go way more expensive and they're going to stand out and you're gonna be like, what the heck was that person thinking? But I'm able to afford a $37 Marcus Semien because I have a $20 Jazz Chisholm, a $16 Jaren Duran, a $9 Marcelo Ozuna, right? Like, this isn't, I'd say, my most valuable roster in terms of like how much value does each player have, but there's a lot of value on this roster. So I knew going in, like, okay, I can get uncomfortable for a second baseman because literally every other position on my offense was filled in except for second base and middle infield, where I'd actually maybe argue that $5 for the current iteration of Nico Horner is more of an overpay than $37 for Marcus Semien for a team that's going for it. Another thing that Semien offers that makes me comfortable overpaying, which sounds stupid, like you should never really want to overpay, but what makes me, he plays every day. He is somebody who I can set and forget. It was a nice feature of having him last year. He's not a great, but he's a decent OBP guy, which counts for this. He should score a lot of runs in that Rangers offense. Like last year, we're thinking like, oh man, Marcus Semien, what a down year. 101 runs, 23 homers. How many second basemen did that? You know? So if even I can tell
you, you want to know how many second base eligible?
I'd guess one. Well, him. Mookie had second base, right? So two.
So, okay. If you talk, no, because Mookie didn't touch those numbers last year. He only played 116
games. Oh, that's right. He had like 19 homers or something, no. Whatever it was.
So you're among currently second base eligible players in Otter New. So understood somebody might have lost it last year that I'm missing here. Currently eligible. Your leader in runs scored is Semien at 101. Altuve was second at 94. Marte, 93. Willie Castro, fourth most runs at 89. Nico Horner at 86. Michael Garcia, 84. Your home run leader at second base was Ketel Marte with 36. Semien second at 23. Then Morel and Lau at 21. Altuve at 20. Betts at 19. Garcia at 18. Down year. And it is worth noting that, like, for all those home runs, like, slugging was not good. His on-base percentage was not good. Like, he hurt you in those rates, and that's something you have to be aware of. But the counting stats, which are, you know, half the offense in this league, he was, I mean, I think you'd probably take Marte's, you know, 8 fewer runs, 13 more home runs. That seems like Marte was better. But he was in the counting stats alone. What?
I would absolutely take Ketel Marte over him for sure.
I'm not even talking about, though. I'm just talking about their counting stats. Like, just looking at that, like, you got one guy number one in runs, the other guy number one in home runs. The 13 more home runs outweighs the 8 more runs from Semien. Yeah. But that's it. No one else is in their class, right? Yeah. Like, anyone else is looking at, you know, Altuve is the closest with 7 fewer runs and 3 fewer home runs. He played 6 fewer games. That doesn't make up for it, right? Like, so, yeah, I think in a down year, Semien was still pretty valuable in this format, I think. So I think you're right to feel good about the floor on Semien, right? Like, he's going to be at the top of that lineup every single day, and he's going to hit you 20 to 25 home runs, and he's probably going to score 100 runs. And that's right. If he's not good, right? If he plays well, the on-base percentage comes back up, although he's never been like a huge on-base percentage guy.
Right.
But the slugging should be back up over 400. Like, you should get good results. So other names that came up in this auction, right towards the end of the right towards the end of the first round of nominations came up Roki Sasaki. He went for $28. And Sasaki at $28 was the second starting pitcher off the board. The first was Zach Gallen for $22. And then after that, we had a $27 Gerrit Cole. We had a $27 Luis Castillo, a $43 Corbin Burns. And then you got a $9 Jesus Luzardo. But that group, right, that $43 Burns, $27 Castillo, $27 Cole, $28 Sasaki, $22 Gallen. What are your thoughts on where all those prices ended up? And at those prices, who do you like best?
I'm going to start with who I like the least. And I'm uncomfortable saying it because I feel like I'm going to jinx him and he's going to have an amazing season. But like Gerrit Cole last year, serious elbow issues. So apparently got them resolved. Missed half the season though. And you could say like, well, it wasn't Tommy John stuff. It was nerve stuff. It's still the guy's elbow, man. And he's in his mid-30s, getting into his older 30s. And he's always kind of had home run problems, right? As much as like an ace pitcher can have home run problems. And that,
which matters in this format quite a bit.
Exactly. And that's the category. Like, this is the format, folks. If you're a long time listener, well, not even a long time, but if you've been listening to the show this offseason, you'll recall that I traded for the worst pitcher in baseball. I traded for Logan Webb. And it's because in this format, Logan Webb actually has some value because he does not give up home runs. And so I'm willing to pay $29 for him. Gerrit Cole's kind of the opposite. So I feel like he's the type of guy who, if you sink mid-20s money into, well, like now you already have to like kind of, you have to account for that in the rest of your roster and be like, all right, well, I can't get any more like real home run risk. Like I can't throw a $5 bid at a Robbie Ray because now my home runs per nine is going to be out of control and I have no chance of contending in that category. So that one I don't love. And Roki Sasaki for $28. I don't think I'm going to have a single share of Roki Sasaki this year. I don't want to spread misinformation. I don't want to contribute to that. I listen to a lot of fantasy baseball podcasts. That's where all of my information on Roki Sasaki comes from. But I thought somebody said, don't quote me on this, that it was like recommended to him by a Japanese doctor that he should get Tommy John surgery, and that he lost a lot of velocity last year. And he's just not the same level of pitcher that Yamamoto is, not by ERA plus, not by a lot of important statistics that we would account for when looking at their numbers overseas. So I'm not saying that Roki's going to be bad, but it's a six-man rotation. It's his first year. They're going to have kitty gloves on him. And like the Tommy John thing just kills me. So if I could have an ace level starting pitcher for $27 or Roki Sasaki for $28, why would I pay $28 for Roki Sasaki? Like, he's going to have to perform so freaking well to be worth $30 next year.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I think there's going to be, the innings won't be very high, both because of the six man rotation and the fact that the Dodgers are going to take it easy on him. And the fact that he has an injury history that is concerning. He's missed time. Yes, I also have heard there was the recommendation that he have Tommy John that he said, "Nah, I'm okay." And
is that maybe, how the doctor works?
I think so.
Can like I just say that? Like, oh no, I don't need that. I'm good.
I mean, you can. They can't cut into you without your permission. So
you're right. You're right.
And this was it God, I'm trying to remember who it was. It was another Japanese pitcher who had like a torn ligament that he just pitched with his whole career.
Tanaka.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was amazing when he first came over here. And then he was so inconsistent after that. I don't know if it's not that's due to injuries, but you're right. That's a great call.
Yeah. And that's the thing. So like, it may be that Sasaki, like, look, there's a little bit of a tear there. He's not worried. He's fine. And that is absolutely a possible outcome here. All right. Like there is a possibility here that like, he's totally healthy. He's fine. He gets his velocity back. The more likely outcome is that he doesn't get the velocity back, that he pitches pretty well, misses some time here and there. But there's a real possibility that he, you know, that surgery recommendation comes back again.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I think you can say every pitcher is an injury risk. And it is true. Every pitcher is an injury risk. Every pitcher is one throw away from Tommy John, right? But some pitchers, that throw is more likely than others. And
some pitchers have already had it recommended.
Right. And so I'm with you. I think the price on him is just too high. I mean, I think even like, I don't know. I see him ranked often in like the top 15. Eno Saris just put his rankings out there and Sasaki is 23rd. I'm looking at who he has. He's got Sasaki 23, Yamamoto 24, Pablo Lopez 25,
really?
Logan Webb 26, Aaron Nola 27, Michael King 28, Joe Ryan 29, Freddy Peralta 30.
Wow.
I move Sasaki. I think he might be outside that top 30 for me.
He's definitely outside the top 30 for me.
I think the this is the reality is in a keeper format, he should be pushed up a little bit. It's worth taking a little bit more risk because of the upside that's there. In the redraft structure that most of these rankings are for, like, I think he's just super risky and I'd be much lower on him. But even in, I don't know, at $28 in this auction, like, I think you've eaten up so much of the upside that I'm not excited about him as a keeper anymore. And so, you know, then if you look at our Fangraph staff league, that one, he went for $31. And if we can look, actually, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll take a look at the highest paid pitchers in that league and how Sasaki fits in with them. All right. Welcome back. Talking about Roki Sasaki and top paid pitchers in auctions. And he makes sense to talk about here because he will be one of the highest paid pitchers in every auto new auction this year because he's available. Right. I mean, it's, you can't pay for a guy that you can't get and he's available. So, but looking at the Fangraphs staff league, this is league 13. It is a head to head Fangraphs points league. The first two pitchers off the board in that one were Yamamoto and Sasaki, $30 Yamamoto, $31 Sasaki. Further down, then you had an $11 Gaussman, a $20 Gallen, a $20 Luis Castillo, $6 Shane Bieber, but that's a whole other world. And then a $25 Bryce Miller. We could probably stop there. I'm looking at this and like Sasaki at 31 as the highest paid pitcher in this draft, I think, just seems like too much.
And what's funny about it is because we just brought up how he went for more than Yamamoto in, I don't think it might have been both leagues. I can't remember. But like, we just went through this with Yamamoto, right? Where it was like, all right, we've never seen this pitcher in the major leagues before, but they have ace level upside. And the conversations we were having is like, if you spend too much for him at auction, he no longer has that keeper appeal. And like, he's probably going to be cut. And guess what? Yamamoto was very good last year. He was awesome when he was on the field, and yet he still got cut at those prices because he did not have that keeper appeal. And granted, he was going for a lot more than these prices on Sasaki, at least if memory serves me correctly. But like the principle of it still applies here. So, I mean, look, we both could be wrong. I mean, all the tools seem to be there for this kid, and he's young and he's on the freaking Dodgers. But something that I thought about while you were speaking about him was like, normally when we think there's injury concern with a pitcher, but then they sign, it's like, oh, okay, well, that team must feel pretty good about it. It doesn't matter to the Dodgers. Like, the Dodgers just want to get the player. He wasn't going to cost that much money no matter what, because he's coming overseas and he has to go through the posting process. But like, if he has to go and get Tommy John surgery tomorrow, the Dodgers are like, okay, you know, well, next guy up, whoever that might be, I guess it would be like Bobby Miller or something. They don't care. So like that level of comfort that I normally get. And I got the opposite with Jack Flaherty signing, right? Cause it was like, whoa, what's wrong with Jack Flaherty? He signed for like nothing compared to what other pitchers were signing for. That level of comfort you get when you think a player might be hurt and then they sign is not there with Sasaki. And I just, too much money. I'm out.
Yeah. We saw this last year too with Yamamoto in a different way, because he did sign a big contract. But when he signed his big contract, there was a lot of people who were like, look how much more he signed for than Cole. That tells you what teams think of him. But Cole signed his contract at like 31 and Yamamoto was like 25 or whatever. And I was like, it's just not apples to apples. You got to be. So right. I'm very much with you that what major league teams do with their real dollars is a really, really good indication of what a player is worth. And you just have to look at the context around that before you just jump right in and say like, oh, its contract is bigger than this guy's. Therefore, right. We're getting the same thing now. I feel like there's been some like chatter about Bregman's contract. Oh, I got 40 million AAV. Like, he didn't get 40 million AAV, right? There's a bunch of deferrals in there. It's not that much. And it's important to remember that, because if you just look at it at the surface and you're like, wow, multiple teams were in on the bidding and the Red Sox had to go that high, what does that tell us about what major league teams think about him? It tells us something, but make sure you're using the right numbers and make sure you're using the right comparison. And, you know, nobody gave Sasaki a lot of money. And that doesn't mean that they don't value him. They couldn't give him a lot of money. There was no way to do it. But it's important to remember that, you know, the fact that there was so much excitement around him. Part of that excitement is like, if he needs Tommy John tomorrow, it doesn't actually change his value in the process that just happened, because he was going to get the same contract no matter what. So if you had told every team in Major League Baseball in December, hey, he's being posted, but in March he's going to undergo the knife and he's going to miss the entire season, it wouldn't have changed how they acted. They all would have done the same thing. They all would have done the exact same thing and been happy to stash him for a year. So I think that's definitely a good point. Other pitcher I want to talk about here real quick. Zach Gallen, it was available in both of these leagues. He was in the sort of the top tier of available pitchers in both these leagues and was the cheapest. Went for $20 in one of them, $22 in the other. I look at Zach Gallen's numbers from last year and like, I don't know, like, he had a 3.65 ERA the year before, it was 3.47. He had a 3.38 FIP the year before, it was 3.26. The XFIP went up a little bit. The strikeouts were from 26% to 25.1%. The walks were the big change, right? An increase in walk rate from 5.6% to 8.7%. And then he had another good year in terms of avoiding home runs. He had an increase in his ground ball rate. I sort of feel like his value has dropped, and I'm not really sure I have a great sense of why, unless it's just the number of innings. If people are just like, he only threw 148 innings last year, that's not enough, therefore I'm down on him? Is that all it is?
I've had a hard time nailing it down as well, because, you know, it's funny we talk about Gallen after just mentioning Masahiro Tanaka, because we're talking about guys who like seem to avoid Tommy John surgery. And if you remember, it was like Gallen was like destined to go under the knife. He was having elbow issues and it was like, oh, it's not looking good. And then he came back and I'm like, yeah, how long is this going to last? And then he's rattled off some like Cy Young caliber season since then. So I don't know if it's carryover from concern over the elbow, because once you have elbow problems as a pitcher, until that gets addressed, it just feels like it's inevitable. And you combine that with the fact that he missed time last year. But otherwise, you're right. Like, hit. One thing I would look at if we thought like, oh, he's going to get injured, is fastball velocity. His four-seamer actually went up 0.1 miles an hour last year. So it's not like he lost velo on the fastball. You could say the swing strike rate isn't great, because he sat there last year with a 10.6% swing strike rate. That was a half percentage drop from 2023. But at 10.6, he's a career 10.8% swing strike rate percentage guy. So like, I don't know. This is a good example, because to bring it back to Sasaki, not that we're going to break him down again, 31 for Sasaki or 28 for Sasaki or $20 for Zach Gallen. Like, I'd rather have Zach Gallen this year.
And Gallen, by the way, while he did miss time, he made 28 starts last year. Right.
He's a horse.
His last 3 years, he's made 31, 34, and 28 starts. The innings were down last year. And that is like, you do have to have a little concern about like, does that, you know, fewer innings per start? What does that mean? Especially if you're in like a 5x5 or a quality starts league. I get that. But it really feels like there's been an overcorrection on Gallen that I'm just not sure I fully buy into.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's he's a weird player that's kind of dropping. I wonder how much of it, Chad, is just because, you know, something that's being talked about in this early draft season is how deep it seems that starting pitcher is. And it feels like Zach Gallen is maybe like right outside of that ace class, right? Certainly after last season, he's outside of that like ace class. And so if he's that like next tier, whatever that is to you listeners, if that's tier three, tier four, whatever it is, does that kind of like, I don't know, push him down? I feel like we're seeing the same thing with Luis Castillo, who I think was worse than Gallen last year. That like, there's just seems to be some values on these pitchers who have pitched like aces before, aren't exactly old, but they're not a Zach Wheeler, a Tarik Skubal, a guy like that. So they just kind of get pushed down. I don't know what it is, but I would agree. There's value.
What do you think about Corbin Burnes, who, in, you know, he wasn't available in the staff league, but in the other league, he went for $43, just like a full tier of his own, well above the rest of these guys.
Yeah. Well, Burnes wasn't available in the staff league because I kept him for 39. So seeing him go for 43 is good. I think I was the one that actually cut him in the listener league, and I had, I don't know, it was like $50 or something. I'm obviously not going to keep him there. I think I love Corbin Burnes. I kind of expect him to have a great season. I wouldn't be surprised, because we've talked about this in the past. The September he showed was like pretty promising in regards to strikeouts. The strikeout rate was up in September, so maybe the strikeouts come back a little bit over in Arizona, and I'm certainly happy to have him out of the AL East. But with that, all of that said, what we just said about Zach Gallen and maybe some like mid-level ace caliber guys getting pushed down, I don't know if I want a $40 starting pitcher this year. You know, like I think I'd rather allocate my dollars elsewhere. But if that was like this team's need and they had the money to spend and they have values elsewhere on the roster, that's where like it doesn't matter. You just pay whatever it takes to get the player and then reap the reward.
Yeah, and I think that's an important note on auction strategy in keeper leagues in general. And to a lesser extent, drafts. I mean, even in a keeper draft, like I'm pretty quick to say like I wouldn't use a first round pick on a pitcher this year. There just isn't a pitcher I think I want to spend a first round pick on. If I were in a keeper league where my team is stacked, I might reach for Skeens or Skubal or Wheeler or someone like that in the first round if I've got a nice strong offense and the pitching is what I need, because I may not be better off adding, thinking about who might be available in the first round of a keeper league, like maybe, you know, maybe a guy like Soto was taken in the first round last year. He's available this year as a result. And when my pick comes up, my choices are, you know, Soto, Betts, Tatis, or one of those pitchers. If my offense is strong enough, maybe I would reach and just go get that arm that I need to make my team a contender. And I think it's one of those areas where average values, ADPs, things like that. Like, you need to be, you want to be aware of those things because they do impact the market. But in keeper leagues, you got to be aware that they're not, they're just not stable, right? They change so much league to league because you don't know team to team what people are going to do. And people are starting from such a different baseline that it shifts values around. And so I think I'm with you on Burns. I don't know that I necessarily want to spend that much on Burns, but if Burns is the guy you need, I get it. And I also, and to be clear here, I should say, that's my $43 Burns, right? And that was what the situation was I wanted an arm. Mm-hmm. And I wanted an arm who I thought I would get a lot of innings out of. And I wanted an arm that I felt good about the home run per fly ball rate. Now, he's been over one, but that's not actually terrible for a starter. And he's moving into a park that actually has suppressed home runs the last few years. And I just wasn't as worried about adding a bat. So that was what I wanted to do. And I am happier having spent $43 on Burns than I think I would have been going to 30 on Cole or Sasaki or Castillo. I do think that Gallen at 22, like if I could have gone to 23, 24 on Gallen instead of 43 on Burns, I probably should have done that.
Well, keep in mind, because that would have also allowed you to then maybe be in the running for Castillo. So if you can get Gallen at that price, it's not just Gallen versus Burns. It's potentially two of them. But I'm with you, and I'm going to take it a step further, and I hope this doesn't come across as like know-it-all-y or anything like that. It's just if you try to get keeper value out of every single one of your players, you're probably never going to win. Like, there's a 0.0% chance that I am keeping a $37 Marcus Semien, or who's going to be $39 for 2026. It's just not going to happen. But I want to win this year, so you pay up to make that happen. And I just don't see, without immense strokes of luck, how anybody could possibly win a league like this if you're trying to get keeper value out of all of these players. Some guys are just assassins. You get them for 1 year, you pay out the nose, and hopefully you win with it.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the outfield in this auction. So in this auction, Mookie Betts went for 58 pretty early. He was the third guy off the board. And I don't even want to talk about him with this group because he's just his own thing. But here are some of the early outfielders off the board. There was a $17 Cody Bellinger. There was a $16 Jorge Soler, a $10 Randy Arozarena, a $20 Luis Robert Jr., and a $36 Mike Trout. You and I were both in the bidding for Bellinger. Neither of us got him. And then I don't think either of us ended up with any of those early outfielders after that. So let's talk a little bit about, like, did the prices, at least for you, did the prices just get too high? Was it like, I'm in on Bellinger at 15 bucks, but he's up to 17. I'm not bidding 18, and all these other guys just got too expensive?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they would have been too expensive for me for two reasons. Well, one, they weren't too expensive for me because I already have a full outfield. I've got a $5 Conforto, a $7 Lowe, $20 Jazz Chisholm, $53 Yordan Alvarez, please stay healthy, and a $16 Jaron Duran. And the other reason is I have a $5 Roman Anthony waiting in the wings. So, like, I could see my outfield taking a turn for the worse. Josh Lowe repeats last year. Michael Conforto somehow gets worse, and all of a sudden I have an issue. So that's why I was kind of in the running for these guys, but I also didn't need to get too uncomfortable because my team just had bigger needs. With that said, that $36 Mike Trout is what gets me thinking about the $37 Marcus Semien, right? Because if I remember, Jazz Chisholm's going to get second base eligibility pretty quickly. I could slide Jazz at second and now have a $37 Mike Trout instead of a $37 Marcus Semien or whatever that ended up being. Now, look, the way the last few years have gone, not even few years, I'd probably rather have the Semien, but the Trout upside is so immense, particularly in like this format with OBP and slugging. He's just a god in those categories when he's on the field. So Trout is the one that actually is most interesting to me, but I didn't need to get uncomfortable for any of those pieces, so I didn't.
Yeah, and for me, I think Bellinger, I was in on the bidding because the bidding had slowed down sort of early, and then I was like, well, I guess I'll get in on this. I kept going into that draft. I kept a $25 Yelich, $22 Teoscar Hernandez, $13 Steer, $19 Hap, $15 Riley Green, $8 so Kerry Carpenter, $6 Matt Wallner, and then I added a $4 Parker Meadows with a $5 Chase DeWater coming, and then I added a $4 Max Kepler. He was just the other outfielder. I just needed a little bit of outfield depth. I also liked Bellinger because my corner infield situation right now is Naylor at first and then Royce Lewis or Itzhak Paredes at third with the other at util. And I liked the idea of Bellinger being another guy I could slot into that trio depending on how things were going. I ended up picking up a $12 Paul Goldschmidt to fill that need. And I think part of what happened for me in both of these drafts, outfield got really expensive.
Yeah.
It felt like outfield overall was just bit up. And so like that $12 Goldschmidt, like I don't love that $12 Goldschmidt, but I think if Goldschmidt had outfield eligibility, he would have gone for like 25 the way this thing was going. And I really need him to fill the same slot that I would have needed an outfielder for. Right. The way my roster is constructed, I didn't need an outfielder. I just needed another bat. And I just was, I don't know. I've been sort of shocked at outfield prices across the board so far.
I agree. And it's particularly surprising because if we said this last year, it wouldn't be surprising at all. But then it felt like a lot of outfielders emerged and that there's actually really good depth in outfield. I think you can get away in standard snake drafts this year. You can get away with getting your third, fourth, fifth outfielders after pick 150. That really didn't feel like it was the case last year.
Right.
And I think a shining example of this was during the auction in League 13. I kind of realized as much as I like Jake McCarthy, I don't think I want him to be my everyday fifth outfielder. Like I want to have some flexibility there. So I was like, I'm going to commit to one of these guys, be it Castellanos, Lourdes Gurriel. I ended up getting Lourdes Gurriel for $17. Like, I'm fine paying it. I needed the player. I still have some room under the $400 cap anyway. Like, I'm fine. I have money to spend. But that's a lot of money for Lourdes Gurriel Jr., who I like, but that's still probably too much. So, yeah, outfield has gotten a little bit out of control.
Yeah, I mean, in this one, like, we needed a second baseman, and ended up with an $8 Gleyber Torres and a $3 Jeff McNeil. And I was glad McNeil didn't get caught up in the outfield mess because he could have. And we ended up just, I don't think, do we got a $1 Max Kepler. You've heard me mention his name in both of these leagues. I'm sort of high.
Chad can't this quit year. Max Kepler. He can't quit him. But
it's a good park for him. It's a good lineup for him. And he's so cheap now, right? The last few years, you were paying like $10 for him, and I couldn't quit him at that price. Now at $1, $4, something like that, I'm thrilled to be getting that. But is he the only? Oh, we got a $1 Jake Fraley. We got a couple of outfielders, I guess. But it's just like we knew we needed a couple of bats, but we weren't really sure what. We got a $1 Ryan O'Hearn, and we got Ryan O'Hearn as one of the last two picks we made, in part because he had outfield eligibility, and we felt like outfield's just been, it's been weird. And so like we went into the draft, we kept a $64 Soto, a $52 Yordan Alvarez, a $31 Schwarber, a $21 Teoscar, $6 Wallner, $6 Parker Meadows. Those guys were all on our roster before the draft. And so we didn't need a lot of outfield, but I am finding in my leagues a couple of things that happen with outfield. One is I'm finding I'm keeping outfielders. Both of these leagues I talked about, it's happening in my other leagues too. I'm keeping a lot of outfielders. And I think that's part of the reason outfield feels deep when you go into like an NFBC type draft and doesn't feel deep in these is all these outfielders who sort of broke out last year or bounced back. Like Teoscar is a great example. Like his price plummeted going into last season. Now it's right back where it was. He's going to be kept everywhere. And so I think that's happening is a lot of teams have kept a lot of outfielders, but everyone still needs another outfielder, right? You can always use another outfielder. And it's resulting in, even though the position feels deeper, there's scarcity in the auction and it's driving prices up as a result is what I think is happening.
No, that makes total sense because it's exactly what we just described. It felt thin last year, which means a lot of these guys that, as you said, broke out, as guys who break out usually are cheap. They're being kept. And if you're still a without when it comes to outfielders, things are going to get a little pricey.
Yeah. Let's take another quick break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the importance of knowing your format and a price that raised some eyebrows, but that I feel really good about. All right, welcome back. I teased that there was a buy I made at one of the auctions that got some questions in the Auto News Slack, but I think the format really matters here, and so I think it's worth talking about. But the third player nominated in the staff league was Tyler Soderstrom. And Niv and I bid up to $5, and we won a $5 Soderstrom. And people were like, what is going on? You know, is he like some secret sleeper you haven't been sharing? But this is where format really matters, because this is a head-to-head Fangraphs Points League. Auto New Leagues, in general, season-long Auto New Leagues, have two catcher spots. And if you've been playing Auto New, you know they have two catcher spots, but they're not two catcher leagues, right? You just have to you just have a second spot so that you can use up your 162 games more easily. Head-to-head does not give you that second slot. And carrying two catchers is actually kind of challenging, I have found, in Auto New head-to-head leagues. Actually, in any head-to-head league. I find carrying two catchers, if you don't have a deep, like, even if you have a deep bench, it's really challenging because, just as an example, most catchers get Sunday off, right? It is super common for a team to play Saturday night. Sunday's an afternoon day. They're traveling, blah, blah, blah. Starting catcher gets a day off. So you take, you know, Adley Rutschman and Sean Murphy, and you feel really good about your catcher pairing. And in a season long out of new league, you start them both Saturday. They both have good matchups. You start them both. You get your two games in. Great. In a head-to-head, you can't do that. And so now you end up the day that Adley is off on Sunday, you're looking forward to starting Murphy, and you can't because he's also off. And so I have found in those head-to-head leagues, I really care about having catchers who play all the time. Whether that's a Sal Perez who catches but also DHs, or a guy like Soderstrom who's a first baseman, but like Soderstrom's going to play almost every day. And he's going to slot into my catcher spot almost every day. And in those head-to-head leagues, if that means I get two extra starts a week out of him over some other catcher, he could be meaningfully worse than another catcher and still be just as valuable, right? So like if I get four starts a week out of a 5 point per game catcher, that's 20 points. That's great. If I get six starts a week out of him at 4 points per game, now he's 24 points per week, right? And he's actually helping my team more than the much better catcher is because of those extra starts. And so I am pushing up catchers who I expect to get a lot of playing time in those formats.
No, I honestly, even if Soderstrom didn't have catcher eligibility, I could see someone just really liking him as a first base sleeper. First base, by the way, not that deep this year. No, and spending $5 for him, because like, I don't want to go and just compare him to Matt Olson, because that's crazy. I'm not saying Tyler Soderstrom is Matt Olson, but it's an interesting one because they both came up with Oakland, and they're just serious power hitters. And Soderstrom, like Olson, had strikeout problems. He cut his strikeout rate from 31% in 2023 to 25% last year. The walk rate went up, and like Olson, his barrel rate and exit velocity is crazy. 14.6% barrel rate is elite. That's just elite. And he's hitting the ball 92 miles an hour on average. So combine all of that and a ballpark change and all that stuff, why can't Soderstrom be just as good of a first base sleeper as almost anyone? Because what are you looking to get out of first base is power. This guy profiles like somebody who could provide a ton of pop. So you combine that all together and give him catcher eligibility. And to your point, the strategy of like, he's going to basically play every day, whereas most catchers won't. That's huge. So I'm fine with a $5 Soderstrom at just first base eligibility with catcher.
I think the other thing I want to note with Soderstrom is he didn't play a ton last year because he was up and down. He missed some time. When he was up, his days off came against lefties, but he did not, from what I can tell, sit against every lefty. He mostly played when he was up. And so he's going to, he's not just a platoon bat. At least they don't seem to be using him that way. And towards the end of the season, he was creeping up in the lineup. He hit third the last day of the season, fourth and fifth the 2 days before that, mostly fifth the week before that, after having hit sixth or seventh prior to that. Earlier in the season when he was up, he hit a lot of fourth and fifth. I think he's going to be in if not the top third of the lineup, then the middle third, and play a lot. And he also, like, Soderstrom was pretty good last year. Like, I think people, I don't know, nobody was paying attention to the A's except for the fact that they might be moving. Like, he had a 322 WOBA last year. That's a 114 WRC plus. Like, that's a solid season. For especially for a catcher, by the way, if you're wondering, 322 WOBA doesn't sound like a 114 WRC plus. That's the park factor at work. But he's moving into a new park, as you said, and so I think he is an interesting sleeper, no matter what. But I think he's more like a $1 endgame sleeper, but in a at least as a 1B. As a catcher, he's maybe a $2, $3 sleeper, but in a head-to-head league, he's really interesting to me.
Yeah, and for what it's worth, Roster Resource has him batting fifth, and he is not in a platoon, according to Roster Resource. And honestly, there's no one that looks like they could really push him unless Nick Kurtz goes absolutely off at AA. But even if he does, I don't know if he'd see major league playtime this year, and they might find a spot for him somewhere else. So there's plenty of opportunity.
And even, honestly, if Kurtz bangs down the door, the obvious move is to move Rooker to left field and move Seth Brown to... I don't know, somewhere else.
Seth Brown can't be moved.
Well,
he is a rock.
Maybe, star. Maybe. But yeah, that's where I am on Soderstrom. I think it was the other quick thing I'll mention. Let me see if I can find this stat again, because I was talking about Soderstrom when this question came up. Let's see. I was comparing him to Adley, because Adley's, you know, going for $25-$30. Soderstrom was better than Adley Rutschman on a point per plate appearance basis last year, and obviously got fewer plate appearances per game last year. But if he's locked into the lineup, that plate appearance per game number should go up, because he shouldn't be getting pinch hit for or being used as a pinch hitter very often. And he, like, obviously, I can't guarantee this, but I would bet on him to have more games played than Adley this year, because I think the A's are going to plug him into the lineup and just use him. And I think one of the things that the Orioles, I hope, if I'm as a fan of the game, I hope they saw last year, was that, like, catchers burn down if you use them every day. And I think we're going to see less Adley Rutschman this year than we saw last year, which I think increases Adley Rutschman's value for what it's worth, because I think he'll be better down the stretch as a result. But it does, again, it's another reason that, like, I think Soderstrom is, in a head-to-head format, is closer than you think to being an elite catcher, because he performed well last year and he should play every day this year. That's really useful. So any other players, any other auction news that you saw that you're like, oh yeah, we should talk about this?
Auction stuff, no, not so much. We definitely had some interesting draft picks if you want to dive into either the head-to-head or the roto.
Which one? Where did you see some interesting stuff? Which one do you want to talk about?
I mean, I guess we could start with the roto, because I think that one kind of fits what you were talking about earlier about, like, knowing your roster and how in keeper leagues, like, some guys may get pushed up like crazy because they fit a specific need. And these leagues are going into their fourth year, I believe, which is crazy. That's really cool. And you'll notice that each year there seems to be more and more people that fill up keeper slots in the 26th, 25th, 24th, 23rd round. And that makes some interesting decisions up top. And so, you know, I traded up. We talked about this before, for the second overall pick, and got Aaron Judge. But then I passed up elite bats that I would almost never, ever do, like Austin Riley, Rafael Devers, Matt Olson, Freddie Freeman, Jazz Chisholm. I passed all of those up to take Zach Wheeler, because I had Judge in the fold, I have Corbin Carroll in the fold, and I have a lot of hitters. So it was just interesting seeing which players kind of got pushed up and which ones didn't, particularly in a roto when it comes to closers.
That was you traded up in the head-to-head.
Was that am I looking at the head-to-head?
Yeah, the head-to-head is where you traded up for second and took Judge.
Okay, that's what I was talking about there. which actually is surprising because closers also seem to have got pushed up in the head-to-head. But either way, I mean, I guess it doesn't really make a difference. I knew my roster. I knew I had some bats in the fold, and I had an opportunity to take Zach Wheeler, so I went with Zach Wheeler.
Yeah, I actually pushed up closers a bit in the head-to-head, which is not something I would normally do. But the way my roster was constructed, I felt like I needed to go after saves.
I put myself in
a position to win saves. And so I took Edwin Diaz in the fifth. I took Tanner Scott in the seventh. I took Trevor McGill in the ninth. And I think I took one other closer. Maybe I kept Miller. No, that's not what I'm looking for. 1 second, let me pull up my roster. Yeah, I kept Mason Miller. So I'm going to go into opening week with Trevor McGill, Mason Miller, Tanner Scott, and Edwin Diaz all in my lineup. And I think that should give me a good boost in the rates. And it should give me, obviously, a strong showing in saves. And it's not going to hurt me as much in strikeouts as it otherwise might, because especially Miller and Diaz will just pile those up.
Mm-hmm.
Although so will Scott. And so then it becomes a question of, can I get enough out of my starting pitching to hold on to the rates and maybe win strikeouts week sometimes? I don't think I'm going to do very well in wins, but if I can win saves, do well in rates, have a shot at strikeouts, like I can do pretty well in the pitching week to week. And then my offense has to be good enough to carry the day. Right. And like, I don't know if I'll be able to do that. We'll see. But that was my thinking, was I hit a point where I was like, man, I don't know how I build a rotation at this point that I feel good about. And so let's go after the bullpens and see if I can pile up some points that way. We'll see how it goes. We'll see how it goes.
In a head-to-head each category, especially if you know that like you're not going to be able to catch up in starting pitching, it's not a bad strategy, because you should set yourself up to win saves, ERA, and whip each week. Right. And even if you don't win strikeouts and wins, if most of the time you're winning three out of the two, by the end of the season, you should look pretty good in those standings. But it was the head-to-head league that I was talking about there, obviously, because of what I said about Aaron Judge. But if you look between round six and eight, from round six to eight, almost an entire round's worth of closers were taken between those rounds. And that's just like something that for me as a big time head to head player was like really surprising to see, because I just don't value saves that much in a head to head, despite keeping two of them. But I had them both on like last round picks.
Right.
It's just interesting. Like for you, it was strategy based, but I'm willing to bet I probably would have done something different in a lot of those other situations that weren't necessarily about building around closers, but to each their own.
That stood out to me. The other thing that you know stood out in this draft to me was we had some early prospect picks. Roman Anthony in the ninth round, Christian Campbell in the 12th, I think were the first two prospects off the board. I get why people are taking them, but keeper costs now. You're talking about, you know, for Anthony to be a keeper, he's got to be worth an eighth round pick next year.
Mm-hmm.
there were no outfielders taken in the eighth round. The outfielders taken in the seventh round were Brandon Nimmo, Tyler O'Neill, and Colton Cowser. It is not to say that I don't think Anthony will be as good as those guys. I think he could be. But it takes a lot to move up that much, right? To go and become a really good outfield bat right off the bat. And I think this league actually did a pretty decent job of waiting. Anthony in the ninth doesn't seem crazy to me. But man, it is a challenge, and it's something to remember when you're doing this. Like in a weird way, taking Anthony in the ninth round of a redraft is almost easier than in a keeper format, because in a keeper format, you're eating up so much of his keeper value by taking him there.
Mm.
I don't know. I find it challenging to know when to jump in and start taking those prospects. Anthony felt a little early to me. Campbell in the 12th felt a lot better. Like if I look at Campbell in the 12th, second baseman who went in the 11th, Renjifo, Keith, India, Laos. Campbell jumping into that group seems better to me than Anthony jumping into the eighth, but I don't know.
Well, those three Red Sox prospects all got promoted to AAA around the same time. And Marcelo never played there because he was hurt. And the other two don't have a lot of experience at AAA, so the Red Sox have an excuse to kind of start them there. Now you factor in defense of this manager that drafted Christian Campbell, Alex Bregman was not a Red Sox by the time this happened, but it was a possibility. Yeah. So I don't know if that delays Campbell at all. But this is why I think it's so much easier to draft prospects in the roto than in the head-to-head. Because in the roto, that's a weekly league. Like, you are probably playing the same players every week unless there's an injury, which allows you to shoot for a lot more upside on your bench, which is why I kept Roman Anthony for a 28th round pick in the roto, because I was like, you know what? I'll just stash him on my bench and it won't hurt me. In a daily head-to-head, that's going to hurt if those guys are not playing up, yeah, with the Red Sox. And so that's where, like, yeah, it's early. It does zap a lot of Roman Anthony's keeper value. Like, Wyatt Langford was going high last year, partly because we had a feeling he was going to start with the Rangers. Jordan Walker and Anthony Volpe went super high a few years ago because we knew they were going to start with their clubs. I don't think Roman Anthony is going to start the season with the Red Sox. And I would say now it's probably a long shot that Christian Campbell's going to, although we have some reports of more issues with Rafael Devers' shoulder. So we'll see how that plays out. But if they don't, if they start in the minors, that really, really hurts. Because not only did you pay a pretty expensive pick to get these players, which does, you know, as you said, hurt their keeper value, but now you're getting nothing out of them while everybody else or most other people are getting value out of their bench.
Yep. And it's definitely a thing to be cognizant of and concerned about. Again, when you think about knowing your format is, yeah, in a weekly league, you're going to have, so like I said, you're going to have somebody locked on your bench anyways. That guy locked on your bench being a guy you might use versus a guy you can't use doesn't change the fact that they're locked on your bench. And so it really, like, the thing in a weekly league is that you can take that shot, and if all of a sudden it looks like Campbell's not going to be up till June, you can make a decision at some point to dump him and pick up somebody else if your roster requires it, or you can wait and see how badly you need him. In a daily league, it's literally like every single day he's not there, you're taking a hit. And so I'm with you. I think it's easier to push those guys up in a weekly league. I end up not really, like, I just end up not taking those kinds of prospects. I do have Jordan Lawler in the roto.
That's different, though, because he's just got to beat Geraldo Perdomo, who I kind of like, who's all right. But Lawler has already played at the major league level. These Red Sox guys have not.
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, I did. And then I'm trying to think. I think I took one prospect in. Did I take a prospect in the head-to-head?
That would be surprising.
I took Noah Schultz.
Okay.
I think I took him pretty late. So if I can find our draft results again. I took Schultz in the 16th round. And so if I look at pitchers, it's a little confusing because the last pitcher taken before I took Schultz was Tyler Glasnow. And you're like, what? But that's because Glasnow was kept at that price. The pitchers that went in the round before him, so you get a sense of what his keeper cost would have to be: Ronald Blanco, Drew Rasmussen, Jesus Luzardo, and Cody Bradford. Schultz is a keeper for me, almost for sure. Right, and I do have to deal with the fact that I don't know when he'll be up, and I may have to sit there with him on my bench for a while, and that can really hurt. But it's my pitching strategy played into that because I went heavy on relievers, which means I'm going to be behind my opponents on innings anyways, and rushing to catch up to them on innings wasn't going to serve my purposes anyways. And so I can sort of afford to be without that bench spot a little bit longer because I strategically planned to have a thinner pitching staff. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how that plays out for me. You know, the upside here is that I go with a thinner pitching staff by like May or June, Schultz gets added to my rotation and becomes a stud. And if it looks like he's not going to be up at some point, I'll just move on. The other thing in the head-to-head league versus the roto league is in the head-to-head league, you can't pick up minor leaguers. In the roto, you can. Mm-hmm. So if I drop Schultz tomorrow, nobody can pick him up till he gets called up.
Right.
And so by the time he does get called up, I can then make a decision of whether I want to get him back or not. I don't have to worry about somebody jumping the gun on him. And so I feel a little bit better about it there for that reason as well.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat as you with Travis Bezzana. So I talked about how a prospect is going to kill you. I did the same thing. Now, granted, I took the number one overall pick in the most recent MLB draft in like the 20th round. That's a lot different than the 9th. That's a lot different than the 12th, in my opinion. However, the drawback is the same. It's still going to eat up a spot on my roster. However, Bezzana is one of those guys who I think, like Roman Anthony, like Christian Campbell, could be called up. So paying a little bit cheaper made me feel a little bit more comfortable doing that. I don't know. And honestly, if my team is playing poorly and I need the spot, I won't hesitate to cut him as much as it might hurt, because I want to compete and it's hurting me. So as long as you're comfortable being willing to do that, which is a lot harder with a 9th round pick, it's not the worst thing in the world.
So the other thing with these guys, and it's true with Anthony, it's true with Campbell, it's true with really all the prospects we talked about, Bezzana, I think, fits into this, is we've got a month now to see what the talk track is around these guys. And like, the Guardians don't have a second baseman, and I don't think Bezzana is next in line to be the Guardians' second baseman. But if February starts going really well and he comes out in March and is hitting the ball and looks like the guy, maybe, right? Like, it's not impossible. And so by taking him when you did, you know, your 20th round pick probably wasn't going to do you any good anyways. Now you have a chance to sit and see. And if it becomes obvious that he's headed for, you know, double A, triple A, whatever, and it's going to be a while, so you cut him, you move on, so be it. You were probably going to move on for your 20th round pick at some point anyways. So I like that. And if you get lucky, all of a sudden he's killing the ball and looks like the starter, you've got a nice pickup.
He also might have, when you get a player that late, like, yeah, he could have some trade value, right? Like, trying to trade Roman Anthony when things are going bad and he's a 9th round keeper, you might struggle. But if I go to the team that's in last or second to last in the standings, you know, a few months into the season, a month into the season, say, hey, I have Travis Bezzana who's tearing up AAA. He could be up any moment, but I need the roster spot. I might be able to get something pretty good for a 20th round Travis Bezzana.
For sure. Well, I think that is a pretty good thorough recap of things that we have seen through our early drafts and auctions. We got more drafts and auctions coming up. I've had a couple dynasty drafts. I have my only redraft draft coming up in 2.5 hours. I'm trying to get ready for that because I'm super ill prepared. I don't think redraft at all. So this is going to be an interesting one. With that, I think we'll let you all get back to your week. This is coming out on President's Day, and if you're like Pete and I, schools are closed for the week. You get some time off. I'm gonna be doing some skiing. Pete, you got any plans for your week off?
I think I'll be at a nice spa, and just a day at the spa should be a nice little day.
Just a day at the spa, sitting back, thinking about how to draft the best possible outfielders, how early you're willing to jump into closers.
Sadly, that's probably exactly what I will be doing.
That's a good use of your time. I hope you enjoy that. Listeners, hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll be back with you in a week.